wondered. He wanted to find out the reason and the background. If he did ask her, he knew she would be honest. He could sense that about her. But it would be better not to get involved, Tengo decided. This was, after all, the Cat Town. Some day he would have to get on the train and go back to the world from which he came. The nurse finished her tasks, put the clipboard back, and gave Tengo an awkward smile.
His condition is unchanged, the same as always.
So he's stable, Tengo said in as cheerful a voice as he could manage, to put a positive spin on it. A half-apologetic smile rose to her lips, and she inclined her head just a touch. She glanced at the book on his lap.
Are you reading that to him?
Tengo nodded. I doubt he can hear it, though.
Still, it's a good thing to do, the nurse said.
Maybe it is or maybe it isn't, but I can't think of anything else I can do.
But not everybody else would do that.
Most people have busier lives than I do, Tengo said. The nurse looked like she was about to say something, but she hesitated. In the end, she didn't say a thing. She looked at his sleeping father, and then at Tengo.
Take care, she said.
Thanks, Tengo answered. After Nurse Adachi left, Tengo waited a while, then began reading aloud once more. In the evening, when his father was wheeled on a gurney to the examination room, Tengo went to the cafeteria, drank some tea, then phoned Fukairi from a payphone. Is everything okay? Tengo asked her.
Yes, everything is okay, she said, just like always.
Everything's fine with me, too, doing the same thing every day.
But time is moving forward.
That's right, Tengo said. Every day time moves forward one day's worth. And what has gone forward can't go back to where it came from.
The crow came back again just a little while ago, Fukairi said. A big crow.
In the evening that crow always comes up to the window.
Doing the same thing every day.
That's right, Tengo said. Just like us.
But it doesn't think about time.
Crows can't think about time. Probably only humans have the concept of time.
Why?
She asked.
Humans see time as a straight line. It's like putting notches on a long, straight stick.
The notch here is the future, the one on this side is the past, and the present is this point right here. Do you understand?
I think so. But actually, time isn't a straight line. It doesn't have a shape. In all senses of the term, it doesn't have any form.
But since we can't picture something without form in our minds, for the sake of convenience, we understand it as a straight line. At this point, humans are the only ones who can make that sort of a conceptual substitution.
But maybe we are the ones who are wrong.
Tengo mulled this over. You mean we may be wrong to see time as a straight line? No response.
That's a possibility. Maybe we're wrong and the crow is right. Maybe time is nothing at all like a straight line. Perhaps it's shaped like a twisted donut. But for tens of thousands of years, people have probably been seeing time as a straight line that continues on forever. And that's the concept they based their actions on. And until now, they haven't found anything inconvenient or contradictory about it. So, as an experiential model, it's probably correct.
Experiential model, Fukairi repeated. After taking a lot of samples, you come to view one conjecture as actually correct. Fukairi was silent for a time. Tengo had no idea if she had understood him or not. Hello, Tengo said, checking if she was still there.
How long will you be there?
Fukairi asked, omitting the question mark. You mean, how long will I be in Chikura?
Yes.
I don't know, Tengo answered honestly. All I can say right now is that I'll stay here until certain things make sense. There are some things I don't understand. I want to stay for a while and see how they develop. Fukairi was silent on the other end again. When she was silent, it was like she wasn't there at all. Hello? Tengo said again.
Don't miss the train,
Fukairi said. I'll be careful, Tengo replied, not to be late for the train. Is everything okay with you?
One person came here a while ago.
What kind of person?
An N.H.K. person.
a fee collector from NHK. "Fee collector?" she asked, again without the question mark. "Did you talk to him?" Tengo asked. I did not understand what he was saying. She apparently had no idea what NHK was. The girl lacked some essential cultural knowledge. "It will take too long to explain over the phone," Tengo said. "But basically, it's a large organization. A lot of people work there. They go around to all the houses in Japan and collect money every month. You and I don't need to pay, because we don't receive anything from them. I hope you didn't unlock the door."
"No, I did not unlock it, like you told me."
"I'm glad."
"But he said you are a thief."
"You don't need to worry about that," Tengo said.
"We have not stolen anything."
"Of course we haven't. You and I haven't done anything wrong." Fukaeri was again silent on the other end of the line. "Hello," Tengo said. Fukaeri didn't reply. She might have already hung up, though he didn't hear any sound that indicated this. "Hello," Tengo repeated, this time more loudly. Fukaeri coughed lightly.
"That person knew a lot about you."
"The fee collector?"
"Yes, the NHK person."
"And he called you a thief?"
"No, he didn't mean me."
"He meant me." Fukaeri didn't reply. "Anyway," Tengo said, "I don't have a TV, so I'm not stealing anything from NHK."
"But that person was very angry that I didn't unlock the door."
"It doesn't matter. Let him be angry. But no matter what happens, no matter what anyone tells you, never, ever unlock the door."
"I won't unlock it."
After saying this, Fukaeri suddenly hung up. Or perhaps it wasn't so sudden. Perhaps for her, hanging up the phone at that point was an entirely natural, even logical act. To Tengo's ear, though, it sounded abrupt. But Tengo knew that even if he were to try his hardest to guess what Fukaeri was thinking and feeling, it wouldn't do any good, as an experiential model. Tengo hung up the phone and went back to his father's room. His father had not been brought back to his room yet. The bed still had a depression in it from his body. No air chrysalis was there. In the room, darkened by the dim, chill dusk, the only thing present was the slight trace of the person who had occupied it until moments ago. Tengo sighed and sat down on the chair. He rested his hands on his lap and gazed for a long while at the depression in the sheets. Then he stood, went to the window, and looked outside. The rain had stopped, and the autumn clouds lingered over the pine windbreak. It would be a beautiful sunset, the first in some time. Tengo had no idea why the fee collector knew a lot about him. The last time an NHK fee collector had come around had been about a year ago. At that time he had stood at the door and politely explained to the man that there was no TV in his apartment. He never watched TV, he continued. The fee collector hadn't been convinced, but he had left without saying any more, muttering some snide remark under his breath. Was it the same fee collector who had come today? He had the impression that that man had also said something about his being a thief. It was a bit odd that the same collector would show up a year later and say he knew a lot about Tengo. They had only stood at the door and chatted for 5 minutes or so, that's all. Whatever. What was important is that Fukaeri had kept the door locked. The fee collector wouldn't be paying another visit any time soon. He had a quota to meet and had to be tired of standing around quarreling with people who refused to pay their subscription fees. In order not to waste time, he would skip the troublesome customers' places and collect the fees from people who didn't have a problem paying. Tengo looked again at the hollow his father had left in the bed, and he remembered all the pairs of shoes his father had worn out. As his father had pounded the Tokyo pavement collecting fees, he had consigned countless pairs of shoes to oblivion. All of the shoes looked the same, cheap, no-nonsense leather shoes, black, with thick soles. He had worn them hard until they were worn out and falling apart, the heels warped out of shape. As a boy, every time Tengo saw these terribly misshapen shoes, it pained him. He didn't feel sorry for his father, but for the shoes. They reminded him of a pitiful work animal, driven as hard as possible and hovering on the verge of death. But come to think of it, Wasn't his father now like a work animal about to die? No different from a worn-out pair of leather shoes. Tengo gazed out the window again as the colors of the sunset deepened in the western sky. He remembered the air chrysalis emitting a faint, pale light, and Aomame as a young girl sleeping inside. Would that air chrysalis ever appear here again? Was time really a straight line? "It seems I've reached a deadlock," Tengo mumbled to the wall. "There are too many variables. Even for a former child prodigy, it's impossible to find an answer." The walls didn't have a response, nor did they express an opinion. They simply and silently reflected the color of the setting sun.
Chapter 4 Ushikawa, Occam's Razor. Ushikawa found it hard to get his head around the idea that the elderly dowager who lived in a mansion in Azabu could somehow be involved with the assassination of Sakigake's leader. He had dug up background information on her. She was a well-known figure in society, so the investigation had not taken much effort. Her husband had been a prominent businessman in the post-war era, influential in the political sphere. His business focused mainly on investments and real estate, though he had also branched out into large-scale retail stores and transport-related businesses. After her husband's death in the mid-1950s, the woman had taken over his company. She had a talent for managing business, as well as an ability to sense impending danger. In the late 1960s, she felt that the company had overextended itself, so she deliberately sold at a high price its stock in various fields and systematically downsized the business. She put all her physical and mental strength into the remaining areas. Thanks to this, she was able to weather the era of the oil shock that occurred soon after with minimal damage and set aside a healthy amount of liquid assets. She knew how to turn other people's crises into golden opportunities for herself. She was retired now and in her mid-70s. She had an abundance of money, which allowed her to live in comfort in her spacious mansion, indebted to no one. But why would a woman like that deliberately plot to murder someone? Even so, Ushikawa decided to dig a little deeper. One reason was that he couldn't find anything else that even resembled a clue. The second reason was that there was something about this safe house that bothered him. There was nothing especially unnatural about providing a free shelter for battered women. It was a sound and useful service to society. The dowager had the financial resources, and the women must be very grateful to her for her kindness. The problem was that the security at the apartment building, the heavy locked gate, the German Shepherd, the surveillance cameras, was too tight for a facility of its type. There was something excessive about it. The first thing Ushikawa did was check the deed for the land and the house that the dowager lived in. This was public information easily ascertained by a trip to City Hall. The deed to both the land and the house were in her name alone. There was no mortgage. Everything was quite clear-cut. As private assets, the property tax would come to quite a sum, but she probably didn't mind paying such an amount. The future inheritance tax would also be huge, but this didn't seem to bother her, which was unusual for such a wealthy person. In Ushikawa's experience, nobody hated paying taxes more than the rich. After her husband's death, she continued to live alone in that enormous mansion. No doubt, she had a few servants, so she wasn't totally alone. She had two children, and her son had taken over the company. The son had three children. Her daughter had married and died 15 years ago of an illness. She left no children behind. This much was easy to find out. But once he tried to dig deeper into the woman's background, a solid wall loomed up out of nowhere, blocking his way. Beyond this, all paths were closed. The wall was high, and the door had multiple locks. What Ushikawa did know was that this woman wanted to keep anything private about her completely out of public view, and she had poured considerable effort and money into carrying out that policy. She never responded to any sort of inquiry, never made any public statements, and no matter how many materials he raked through, not once did he come up with a photograph of her. The woman's number was listed in the Minato Ward phone book. Ushikawa's style was to tackle things head-on, so he went ahead and dialed it. Before the phone had rung twice, a man picked up. Ushikawa gave a phony name and the name of some investment firm and said, "There's something I would like to ask the lady of the house about, regarding her investment funds." The man replied, "She isn't able to come to the phone, but you can tell me whatever she needs to know." His business-like tone sounded mechanical, manufactured. "It's company policy not to reveal these things to anyone other than the client," Ushikawa explained. "So, if I can't speak with her directly now, I can mail the documents to her. She will have them in a few days." "That would be fine," the man said, and hung up. Ushikawa wasn't particularly disappointed that he couldn't speak to the dowager. He wasn't expecting to. What he really wanted to find out was how concerned she was about protecting her privacy. Extremely so, it would appear. She seemed to have several people with her in the mansion who kept a close guard over her. The tone of this man who answered the phone, her secretary most likely, made this clear. Her name was printed in the telephone directory, but only a select group could actually speak to her. All others were flicked away like ants who had crawled into the sugar bowl. Pretending to be looking for a place to rent, he made the rounds of local real estate agencies, indirectly asking about the apartment building used as the safe house. Most of the agents had no idea there was an apartment building at that address. This neighborhood was one of the more upscale residential areas in Tokyo. These agents only dealt with high-end properties and couldn't be bothered with a two-story wooden apartment building. One look at Ushikawa's face and clothes, too, and they essentially gave him the cold shoulder. If a three-legged waterlogged dog with a torn-off tail and mange had limped in the door, they would have treated it more kindly than they treated him. Just when he was about to give up, a small local agency that seemed to have been there for years caught his eye. The yellowed old man at the front desk said, "Ah, that place," and volunteered information. The man's face was shriveled up like a second-rate mummy, but he knew every nook and cranny of the neighborhood and always jumped at the chance to bend someone's ear. "That building is owned by Mr. Ogata's wife, and yes, in the past, it was rented out as apartments. Why she happened to have that building, I don't really know. Her circumstances did not exactly demand that she manage an apartment building. I imagine she mostly used it to house their employees. I don't know much about it now, but it seems to be used for battered women. Kind of like those Kakekomedera temples in the old days that sheltered wives running away from abusive husbands. Anyway, it isn't going to fatten a real estate agent's wallet." The old man laughed with his mouth shut. He sounded like a woodpecker. "A Kakekomedera, eh?" Ushikawa said. He offered him a 7-star cigarette. The old man took it, let Ushikawa light it for him with his lighter, and took a deep, appreciative drag on it. "This is exactly what the 7 stars must long for," Ushikawa mused, "to be enjoyed so thoroughly." "Women whose husbands smack them around and run away, their faces all puffed up, they take shelter there. They don't have to pay rent."
"Like a kind of public service," Ushikawa said.
"Yes, that sort of thing. They had this extra apartment building, so they used it to help people in trouble. She's tremendously wealthy, so she could do whatever she wanted, without worrying about making money, not like the rest of us."
"But why did Mrs. Ogata start doing that? Was there something that led up to it?"
"I don't know,"
She's so rich that maybe it's like a hobby.
Well, even if it is a hobby, Ushikawa said, beaming, that's a wonderful thing, to help people in trouble like that. Not everyone with money to burn takes the initiative to help others.
Of course, it's a nice thing to do,
the old man agreed.
Years ago, I used to hit my old lady all the time, so I'm not one to talk.
He opened his mouth, showing off his missing teeth, and guffawed, as if hitting your wife every once in a while were one of life's notable pleasures.
So, I take it that several people live there now? Ushikawa asked.
I go past there when I take a walk every morning.
But you can't see anything from outside.
But it does seem like a few people are living there. I guess there will always be men in the world who beat their wives.
There are always far more people in the world who make things worse rather than help out.
The old man guffawed again loudly, his mouth wide open.
You got that right. There are a lot more people who do bad things than do good.
The old man seemed to have taken a liking to Ushikawa. This made Ushikawa uncomfortable.
By the way, what sort of person is Mrs. Ogata?
Ushikawa asked, trying to sound casual.
I really don't know that much about her,
the old man replied, knitting his brow like the spirit of an old withered tree.
She lives a very quiet, reserved life. I've done business here for many years, but at most I've caught glimpses of her from afar. When she goes out, she always has a chauffeur, and her maids do all the shopping. She has a man who is like her personal secretary, and he takes care of most everything. I mean, she's a well-bred, wealthy woman, and you can't expect her to talk with the hoi polloi.
The old man frowned, and from the midst of those wrinkles came a wink directed at Ushikawa. By hoi polloi, the old man with the yellowed face seemed to be talking about a group composed primarily of two people, himself and Ushikawa. Ushikawa asked another question.
How long has Mrs. Ogata been active in providing a safe house for victims of domestic violence?
I'm not really sure. I've only heard from others that the place is a kind of kakekomadira. But about 4 years ago, people started to go in and out of that apartment building. 4 or 5 years, something like that.
The old man lifted the teacup to his lips and drank his cold tea.
It was about then that they built a new gate, and the security got tighter. It's a safe house, after all, and if anyone can just wander in, the folks who live there won't be able to relax.
The old man seemed to come back to the present. He looked at Ushikawa a bit suspiciously.
So, you said you were looking for a reasonably priced place to rent?
That's correct.
Then you better try somewhere else. This neighborhood is full of expensive mansions, and even if there are places for rent that come on the market, they're all high-end rentals aimed at foreigners who work in the embassies. A long time ago, there were a lot of regular people who lived around here, ones who weren't so wealthy. As a matter of fact, finding places for them is how our business got started. But there aren't any affordable houses left, so I'm thinking of closing the business. Land prices in Tokyo have skyrocketed, and a small fry like me can't handle it anymore. Unless you have bags of cash to spare, I suggest you try elsewhere.
I'll do that, Ushikawa said. The truth is, I am a bit strapped. I'll try some other location.
The old man breathed out cigarette smoke and a sigh.
But once Mrs. Ogata passes, you can bet that mansion will disappear. That son of hers is a real go-getter. And there's no way he's going to let a prime piece of real estate like that in a premium area just sit around. He'll knock it down in a flash and put up an ultra-high-end condo. He may very well be drawing up the blueprints as we speak.
if that happens. This whole neighborhood won't be quite as serene as it is now.
Yep, you won't recognize it.
You mentioned her son. What business is he in?
Basically, he's in real estate, the same as me. But the difference between us is like chalk and cheese, like a Rolls Royce and an old bicycle. He takes a huge amount of capital and then makes investments on his own, one after another. He licks up all the honey himself without leaving a drop behind. Nothing spills over in my direction. I can tell you that. The world sucks, that's for sure.
I was just walking around a while ago and wandered all around the outskirts of that mansion. I was impressed. It's quite a place.
Well, it's definitely the best residence in this neighborhood. When I picture those beautiful willow trees being chopped down, it hurts.
The old man shook his head as if he really were in pain.
I can only hope that Mrs. Ogata lives a little longer.
I hear you, Ushikawa agreed.
Ushikawa found a listing for the Center of Victims of Domestic Violence in the phone book and decided to contact them. It was a non-profit organization run by volunteers and headed by several lawyers. Ushikawa made an appointment in the name of his phony office, the New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts. He led them to believe he might be a potential donor, and they set the time for the appointment. Ushikawa proffered his business card, which was the same as the one he had given to Tango, and explained how one of the purposes of his foundation was to pinpoint an outstanding non-profit organization that was making a real contribution to society and provide them with a grant. Though he couldn't reveal who the sponsor was, the grant could be used in any way the recipient wished. The only requirement was to submit a simple report by the end of the year. Ushikawa's appearance didn't inspire any goodwill or trust, and the young lawyer he spoke with eyed him warily at first. However, they were chronically short on funds and had to accept any support, no matter the source.
"I'll need to know more about your activities," Ushikawa said.
The lawyer explained how they had started the organization. Ushikawa found this history boring, but he listened carefully, his expression one of devoted interest. He made all the appropriate noises, nodded in all the right places, and kept his expression docile and open. As he did, the lawyer warmed up to him. Ushikawa was a highly trained listener, adopting such a sincere and receptive manner that he almost always succeeded in putting the other person at ease. He found the opportunity to casually nudge the conversation in the direction of the safe house. For the unfortunate women who are running away from domestic violence, he asked, if they can't find an appropriate place to go, where do they end up living? He put on an expression that showed his deep sympathy for these women, whose fate was like that of leaves tossed about in some outrageously strong wind. "In instances like that, we have several safe houses where they can go," the young lawyer replied.
"Safe houses?"
"Temporary refuges. There aren't many, but there are places that charitable people have offered us. One person has even provided an entire apartment building for us to use."
"An entire apartment building?"
Ushikawa said, sounding impressed.
"I guess some people can be quite generous."
"That's right. Whenever our activities are covered in newspapers or magazines, inevitably we'll get a call from people wanting to help out. Without offers from people like that, we would never be able to keep this organization going, since we depend almost entirely on contributions."
"What you're doing is very meaningful," Ushikawa said.
The lawyer flashed him with a vulnerable smile.
"Nobody's easier to fool," Ushikawa thought, "than the person who is convinced that he is right. How many women would you say are living in that apartment building now?"
"It depends, but let's see. I would say usually 4 or 5, the lawyer said.
"About that charitable person who provided that apartment building," Ushikawa said. "How did this person get involved? I'm thinking there must have been some event that led up to this interest."
The lawyer tilted his head. I really don't know, though in the past this person was, it seems, involved in similar activities on an individual level. As far as we're concerned, we're just grateful for this individual's kindness. We don't ask the reasons behind it.
Of course. Ushikawa nodded. I assume you keep the locations of your safe houses secret.
Correct. We have to make sure that the women are protected. Plus, many of our donors prefer to remain anonymous. I mean, we're dealing with acts of violence, after all. They talked for a while longer, but Ushikawa was unable to extract any more useful information. What Ushikawa knew were the following facts. The Center for Victims of Domestic Violence had begun operations in earnest 4 years ago. Not long afterward, a certain donor had contacted them and offered them use of a vacant apartment building as a safe house. The donor had read about their activities in the newspaper. The donor had set one condition, namely that the donor's name never be revealed. Still, from what was said, Ushikawa could deduce that beyond any doubt, the donor was the elderly dowager living in Azabu, the one who owned the apartment building.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, Ushikawa said warmly to the idealistic young lawyer. Your organization is certainly making a valuable contribution. I'll present what I have learned here to our board of directors. We should be getting in touch with you fairly soon. In the meantime, my very best wishes for your continued success.
Next, Ushikawa began to investigate the death of the dowager's daughter. The daughter had married an elite bureaucrat in the Ministry of Transport and was only 36 when she died. He didn't know the cause yet. Not long after she died, her husband left the Ministry of Transport. These were the only facts Ushikawa had unearthed so far. He didn't know why the husband had left the ministry or what sort of life he had led afterward. The Ministry of Transport was not the sort of government office that willingly revealed information regarding its inner workings to ordinary citizens. But Ushikawa had a sharp sense of smell, and something smelled fishy. He couldn't believe that losing his wife would have made the man so overcome with grief that he would quit his job and go into hiding. Ushikawa knew there weren't many 36-year-old women who died of illness. Not that there weren't some. No matter how old you are or how blessed your circumstances, you can suddenly fall ill and die from cancer, a brain tumor, peritonitis, acute pneumonia. The human body is a fragile thing. But for an affluent woman of 36 to join the ranks of the dead, in all likelihood, it was not a natural death, but either an accident or suicide.
Let me speculate here, Ushikawa said to himself. Following the famous rule of Occam's razor, I'll try to find the simplest possible explanation. Eliminate all unnecessary factors, boil it all down to one logical line, and then look at the situation. Let's say the dowager's daughter didn't die of illness but by suicide.
Ushikawa rubbed his hands together as he pondered this.
It wouldn't be hard to pretend that a suicide was actually death by illness, especially for someone with money and influence. Take this a step further and say that this daughter was the victim of domestic violence, grew despondent, and took her own life. Certainly not an impossibility. It was a well-known fact that certain members of the so-called elite had disgusting personalities and dark, twisted tendencies, as if they had taken more than their share of darkness allotted to them. If that were the case, what would the rich old dowager do? Would she call it fate, say that nothing else could be done, and give up? Not very likely. She would take suitable revenge against whatever force had driven her daughter to her untimely end.
Ushikawa felt he had a better understanding of the dowager. She was a daring, bright woman, with a clear vision and a strong will. And she would spare neither fortune nor influence to avenge the death of the one she loved. Ushikawa had no way of knowing what kind of retaliation she had actually taken toward her daughter's husband, since all trace of him had vanished into thin air. He didn't think that the Dowager had gone so far as to take the man's life, but he had no doubt that she had taken some sort of decisive action, and it was hard to believe that she had left any trail behind. Ushikawa's conjectures thus far seemed to make sense, though he had no proof. His theory, however, did clear up a lot of questions. Licking his lips, Ushikawa vigorously rubbed his hands together. Beyond this point, though, things started to get a little hazy. The Dowager had set up the safe house to sublimate her desire for revenge, turning it into something more useful and positive. Then, at the sports club she frequented, she got to know the young instructor, Aomame, and somehow, he had no idea how, they came to a secret understanding. After meticulous preparation, Aomame got access to the suite at the Hotel Okura and murdered Leader. The method she used was unclear. Aomame might be quite proficient in murdering people using a special technique. As a result, despite being closely guarded by two very dedicated and able bodyguards, Leader wound up dead. Up to this point, the threads tying his conjectures held together, barely. But when it came to linking Sakigake's Leader to the Center for Battered Women, Ushikawa was at a total loss. At this point, his thought process hit a roadblock, and a very sharp razor neatly severed all the threads. What Sakigake wanted from Ushikawa at this point were answers to two questions. Who planned the murder of Leader, and where was Aomame? Ushikawa was the one who had run the original background check on Aomame, and he had found nothing suspicious about her at all. But after she had left, Leader expired. And right after that, Aomame disappeared. Poof. Like a gust of smoke in the wind. Sakigake had to be very upset with Ushikawa, convinced that his investigation hadn't been thorough enough. But in fact, as always, his investigation left nothing to be desired. As he had told Buzzcut, Ushikawa was a stickler for making sure all the bases were covered. He could be faulted for not having checked her phone records beforehand, but unless there was something extraordinarily suspicious about a situation, that wasn't something he normally did. And as far as he could tell from his investigations, there wasn't a single suspect thing about Aomame. Ushikawa didn't want them to be upset with him forever. They paid him well, but they were a dangerous bunch. Ushikawa was one of the few who knew how they had secretly disposed of Leader's body, which made him a potential liability. He knew he had to come up with something concrete to show them, so they would know he was a valuable resource, someone worth keeping alive. He had no proof that the old dowager from Azabu was mixed up in Leader's murder. At this point, it was pure speculation. He did know that some deep secret lay hidden inside that mansion with its magnificent willows. Ushikawa's sense of smell told him this, and his job was to bring that truth to light. It wouldn't be easy. The place was under heavy guard, with professionals involved. Yakuza? Perhaps. Businessmen, those involved in real estate in particular, are often involved in secret negotiations with Yakuza. When the going gets rough, the Yakuza get called in. It was possible the old dowager might be making use of their influence. But Ushikawa wasn't very certain of this. The old dowager was too well-bred to deal with people like them. Also, it was hard to imagine that she would use Yakuza to protect women who were victims of domestic violence. Possibly she had her own security apparatus in place, one that she paid for herself, her own personal system she had refined. It would cost her, but then she wasn't hurting for funds. And this system of hers might employ violence when there was a perceived need. If Ushikawa's hypothesis was correct, then Aomame must have gone into hiding somewhere far away with the aid of the old dowager. they would have carefully erased any trail, given her a new identity and a new name, possibly even a new face. If that was the case, then it would be impossible for Ushikawa's painstaking little private investigation to track her down. At this point, the only thing to do was to try to learn more about the Dowager. His hope was that he would run across a seam that would lead him to discover something about Aomame's whereabouts. Things might work out, and then again they might not. But Ushikawa had some strong points, his sharp sense of smell and his tenaciousness. He would never let go of something once he latched onto it. Besides these, he asked himself, what other talents do I have worth mentioning? Do I have other abilities I can be proud of? Not one. Ushikawa answered himself, convinced he was right.
Chapter 5. Aomame. No matter how long you keep quiet. Aomame didn't find it painful to be shut away, living a monotonous, solitary existence. She got up every day at 6:30 and had a simple breakfast. Then she would spend an hour or so doing laundry, ironing, or mopping the floor. For an hour and a half in the morning, she used the equipment Tamaru had obtained for her to do a strenuous workout. As a fitness instructor, she was well-versed in how much stimulation all the various muscles needed every day, how much exercise was just right, and how much was excessive. Lunch was usually a green salad and fruit. The afternoon was spent sitting on the sofa and reading or taking a short nap. In the evening, she would spend an hour preparing dinner, which she would finish before 6. Once the sun set, she would be out on the balcony, seated on her garden chair, keeping watch over the playground. Then to bed at 10:30. One day was the same as the next, but she never felt bored. She was not very social to begin with, and never had a problem going long stretches without seeing or talking with other people. Even when she was in elementary school, she seldom talked with her classmates. More accurately, unless it was absolutely necessary, no one else ever spoke to her. Compared with the harsh days of her childhood, being holed up in a neat little apartment, not talking to anybody, was nothing. Compared with staying silent while those around her chatted away, it was much easier and more natural to be silent in a place where she was all alone. And besides, she had a book she could read. She had started reading the Proust volumes that Tamaru had left for her. She read no more than 20 pages a day. She read each and every word carefully, working her way through each day's reading. Once she finished that section, she read something else. And just before bed, she made sure to read a few pages of Air Chrysalis. This was Tengo's writing, and it had become a sort of manual she followed to live in 1Q84. She also listened to music. The elderly dowager had sent over a box of classical music cassettes. Mahler symphonies, Haydn chamber music, Bach keyboard pieces, all varieties and types of classical music. There was a tape of Janáček's Sinfonietta as well, which she had specifically requested. She would listen to the Sinfonietta once a day as she noiselessly went through her exercise routine. Autumn quietly deepened. She had the feeling that her body was slowly becoming transparent. Aomame tried her best to keep her mind clear of any thoughts, but it was impossible not to think of anything. Nature abhors a vacuum. At the very least, though, she felt that now there was nothing for her to hate. There was no need to hate her classmates and teacher anymore. Aomame was no longer a helpless child, and no one was forcing her to practice a religion now. There was no need to hate the men who beat up women. The anger she had felt before, like a high tide rising up within her, the overwrought emotions that sometimes made her want to smack her fists against the closest wall, had vanished before she realized it. She wasn't sure why, but those feelings were entirely gone. She was grateful for this. As much as possible, she wanted never to hurt anyone ever again, just as she didn't want to hurt herself. On nights when she found it hard to sleep, she thought of Tamaki Otsuka and Ayumi Nakano. When she closed her eyes, the memory of holding their bodies close came rushing back to her. Both of them had had soft, lustrous skin and warm bodies. Gentle, profound bodies, with fresh blood coursing through them, hearts beating regular, blessed beats. She could hear them sigh softly and giggle. Slender fingers, hardened nipples, smooth thighs. But these two women were no longer in the world. Like dark, soft water, sadness took over Aomame's heart, soundlessly and with no warning. The best antidote at a time like this was to just shut off that stream of memories and think only of Tengo. Focus and recall the touch of the 10-year-old boy's hand as she had held it for a fleeting moment. And then she called forth from memory the 30-year-old Tengo sitting on top of the slide. She imagined what it would feel like to be held in those large, strong arms. He was almost within reach. Maybe if I hold out my hand the next time, I really will be able to reach him. In the darkness, she closed her eyes and immersed herself in that possibility. She gave herself up to her longing. But if I never do see him again, she thought, her heart trembling, then what? Things had been a whole lot simpler when there was no actual point of contact between them. Meeting the adult Tengo had been a mere dream, an abstract hypothesis. But now that she had seen the real him before her very eyes, his presence was more concrete, more powerful than it had ever been before. She had to see him, to have him hold her, caress every part of her. Just the very thought that this might not come to pass made her feel as if her heart and body were being ripped in two. Maybe back there, in front of the Esso Tiger on the billboard, I should have shot that 9mm bullet into my skull. Then I wouldn't have to live like this, feeling such sadness and pain. But she just couldn't pull the trigger. She had heard a voice. From far off, someone calling her name. I might be able to see Tengo again, she had thought. And once this thought had struck her, she had to go on living. Even if what Leader had said was true, that doing so would make things dangerous for Tengo, she had no other choice. She had felt an unbearably strong surge of the life force, beyond the bounds of logic. The upshot was that she was burning with a fierce desire for him. It was a thirst that wouldn't quit, and a premonition of despair. A realization struck her. This is what it means to live on. When granted hope, a person uses it as fuel, as a guidepost to life. It is impossible to live without hope. Aomame's heart clenched at the thought, as if every bone in her body were suddenly creaking and screaming out. She sat at the dining table and picked up the automatic pistol. She pulled back the slide, sending a bullet into the chamber, thumbed back the hammer, and stuck the muzzle in her mouth. Just a touch more pressure with her trigger finger, and all this sadness would disappear. Just a touch more. One more centimeter. No. If I pull my finger just 5 millimeters toward me, I will shift over to a silent world where there are no more worries. The pain will only last an instant. And then there will be a merciful nothingness. She closed her eyes. The Esso Tiger from the billboard, gas hose in hand, grinned at her. Put a tiger in your tank. She pulled the hard muzzle out of her mouth and slowly shook her head. I can't die. In front of the balcony is the playground. The slide is there. And as long as I have the hope that Tengo will show up again, I won't be able to pull this trigger. This possibility drew her back from the brink. One door closed inside her heart, and another door opened, quietly, without a sound. Almame pulled the slide again, ejecting the bullet, set the safety, and placed the pistol back on the table. When she closed her eyes, she sensed something in the darkness, a faint light, fading away by the moment. What it could be, she had no idea. She sat down on the sofa and focused on the pages of Swan's Way. She imagined the scenes depicted in the story, trying hard not to let other thoughts intrude. Outside, a cold rain had started to fall. The weather report on the radio said a gentle rain would continue until the next morning. A weather front was stalled out in the Pacific, like a lonely person lost in thought, oblivious of time. Tengo won't be coming, she thought. The sky was covered from one end to the other with thick clouds blocking out the moon. Still, she would probably go out onto the balcony, a hot cup of cocoa in hand, and watch the playground. She would keep binoculars and the pistol nearby, wear something decent enough so that she could quickly run outside and gaze at the slide in the rain. This was the only meaningful act she could undertake. At 3 p.m., someone at the entrance of the building rang her bell. Almame ignored it. It wasn't possible that anyone would be visiting her. She had the kettle on for tea, but to be on the safe side, she switched off the gas and listened. The bell rang 3 or 4 times, and then was silent. About 5 minutes later, a bell rang again. This time it was the doorbell to her apartment. Now someone was inside the building, right outside her door. The person may have followed a resident inside, or else had rung somebody else's bell and talked their way in. Almame kept perfectly still. "If somebody comes, don't answer," Tamaru had instructed her. "Set the deadbolt and don't make a sound." The doorbell must have rung 10 times. A little too persistent for a salesman. They usually give up at 3 rings. As she held her breath, the person began to knock on the door with his fist. It wasn't that loud a sound, but she could sense the irritation behind it. "Miss Takai," a low, middle-aged man's voice said, a slightly hoarse voice. "Miss Takai, can you please answer the door?" Takai was a fake name on the mailbox. "Miss Takai, I know this isn't a good time, but I would like to see you, please." The man paused for a moment, waiting for a response. When there was none, he knocked on the door again, this time a little louder. "I know you're inside, Miss Takai, so let's cut to the chase and open the door. I know you're in there and can hear me." Almame picked up the automatic pistol from the table and clicked off the safety. She wrapped the pistol in a towel and held it by the grip. She had no idea who this could be, nor what he could possibly want. His anger seemed directed at her. Why, she had no clue. And he was determined to get her to open the door. Needless to say, in her present position, this was the last thing she wanted. The knocking finally stopped, and the man's voice echoed again in the hallway. "Miss Takai, I am here to collect your NHK fee." "That's right, good old NHK. I know you're at home. No matter how much you try to stay quiet, I can tell. Working this job for so many years, I know when someone is really out and when they're just pretending. Even when a person tries to stay very quiet, there are still signs he's there. People breathe, their hearts beat, their stomachs continue to digest food. Miss Takai, I know you're in there, and that you're waiting for me to give up and leave. You're not planning to open the door or answer me, because you don't want to pay the subscription fee. The man's voice was louder than it needed to be, and it reverberated down the hallway of the building. That was his intention, calling out the person's name so loudly that it would make them feel ridiculed and embarrassed. And so it would be a warning to all the neighbors. Almama kept perfectly silent. She wasn't about to respond. She put the pistol back on the table. Just to be sure, though, she kept the safety off. The man could just be pretending to be an NHK fee collector. Seated at the dining table, she stared at the front door. She wanted to stealthily pad over to the door, look through the peephole, and check out what kind of person he was. But she was glued to the chair. Better not do anything unnecessary. After a while, he would give up and leave. This man, however, seemed ready to deliver an entire lecture. "Mr. Kai, let's not play hide-and-seek anymore, okay? I'm not doing this because I like to. Even I have a busy schedule. Mr. Kai, I know you watch TV. And everyone who watches TV, without exception, has to pay the NHK subscription fee. You may not like it, but that's the law. Not paying the fee is the same as stealing, Mr. Kai. You don't want to be treated as a thief because of something as petty as this, do you? This is a fancy building you live in, and I don't think you will have any trouble paying the fee. Right? Hearing me proclaim this to the world can't be much fun for you. Normally, Almame wouldn't care if an NHK fee collector was making a racket like this. But right now she was in hiding, trying to keep out of sight. She didn't want anything to attract the attention of other residents. But there was nothing she could do about it. She had to keep still and wait until he went away. I know I'm repeating myself, Miss Takai, but I am sure you're in there listening to me. And you're thinking this, why, of all places, did you have to choose my apartment to stand outside of? I wonder too, Miss Takai. It's probably because I don't like people pretending not to be at home. Pretending not to be at home is just a temporary solution, isn't it? I want you to open the door and tell me to my face that you don't have any intention of paying the NHK fee. You would feel much better, and so would I. That would leave some room for discussion. Pretending to be out is not the way to go. It's like a pitiful little rat hiding in the dark. It only sneaks out when people aren't around. What a miserable way to live your life. This man's lying, Almame thought. That's just ridiculous, that he can sense when somebody is at home. I haven't made a sound. His real goal is to just stand in front of a random apartment, make a racket, and intimidate all the other residents to make people decide they would prefer to pay the fee than to have him plant himself outside their door like that. This man must have tried the same tactics elsewhere and had good results. Miss Takai, I know you find me unpleasant. I can understand perfectly what you're thinking. And you're right. I am an unpleasant person. I'm aware of that. But you have to understand, Miss Takai, that pleasant people don't make good fee collectors. There are tons of people in the world who have decided they aren't going to pay the NHK subscription fee. And if you're going to collect from people like that, you can't always act so nice. I would rather leave with no problem. Just say, is that right? You don't want to pay the fee? I understand. Sorry to bother you. But I can't. Collecting the fee is my job. And besides, personally, I don't like it when people pretend not to be at home. The man stopped and paused. And then he knocked on the door 10 times in a row. Miss Takai, you must be finding this annoying. Aren't you starting to feel like a real thief by now? Think about it. We're not talking about a lot of money here. Enough to buy a modest dinner at your neighborhood chain restaurant. Just pay it, and you won't be treated like a thief.